Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Truth on the Tracks. I'm Brandon Turbeville, your host. Tonight is February 12th, 2017. The show is being recorded on February 11th. Now, before we get into the show, I want to apologize for any noise that you might hear. We're at a new location, different location, and there's a lot more road noise, traffic noise, and such, so it might be bleeding into the recording, so I apologize for that, but it shouldn't be so loud that you can't hear what I'm trying to say. Now, I want to talk about a number of different issues tonight. I want to get into the Syrian issue, of course, because we got to address the Amnesty International report. Perhaps we can talk about Donald Trump. Perhaps we can also talk about some other more philosophical issues that we should address. Now, before we actually get into the discussion, I want to welcome everybody to the show and remind you that you can catch Truth on the Tracks every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's when the new broadcast is released. And, of course, you can find my work at activistpost.com, naturalblaze.com, eraofwisdom.org. My work specifically, however, I would encourage you to go to brandonturbeville.com, and that is the website where I repost all of my articles, all of the YouTube videos, all of the books, all of the relevant information is there at brandonturbeville.com. So please go there and check out the website. Also, I guess I should mention, if you can't tell, a little bit under the weather today, but hopefully we'll be back in typical form soon enough. Now, I want to talk about, the book, the new book, Resisting the Empire, The Plan to Destroy Syria and How the Future of the World Depends on the Outcome, is now available. You can buy it at brandonturbeville.com. You can buy it at Amazon. And those are the two places you can buy it. Of course, if you go to brandonturbeville.com, it's actually going to send you back to Amazon. And this is a book. It's around 398 pages. It's all about the Syrian crisis. And you should know, by the time you finish the book, all the ins and outs of the Syrian crisis. It's the best book that I've put together and released so far, if I may say so myself. And just briefly to go through, the preface is written by Afra Dogger. She's a Syrian researcher, analyst, who's been a regular guest on my show, a good friend of mine. And, of course, you can go hear her interviews. She's also a Syrian and who lives in Syria. So her perspective is well worth it, very important. The sections that we have in here are the discussions about the moderate opposition. Of course, there are no moderates, and this chapter will explain that whole situation. We also talk about fake humanitarian organizations, which is something that is relevant to today because of the Amnesty International report. America's ceasefires. We talk about the questionable nature of the ceasefires that constantly get cropping up, and of course America's propaganda. This is a fairly thick part of the book because we talk about the propaganda, the methods of propaganda, how it's worked in the past. Another chapter 5, ISIS made in the USA. We track down the history of ISIS, where it comes from, and all of its roots, and not just ISIS but the other terrorist organizations as well. Who benefits is another section where we talk about who is actually involved, right? This is the players, the national players, Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United States, NATO, etc. Of course, Russia. And then we're going to chapter 7, Back to the Beginning, which will take you again back to the very beginning of the nature of the crisis and try to catch everyone up to the very nature of what it was like from the beginning. And it also talks about the funding. Chapter 8, Al-Qaeda, the CIA's Arab Legion, again, it ties in with Chapter 5 about ISIS, where you understand that Al-Qaeda is actually an American creation. Chapter 9 is The Nature of Destabilization, and this is a chapter that's all about color revolutions and their recent history. Chapter 10 is Russia and World War III. This talks about the implications for the continuation of a war in Syria, Russia's interest, and the possibility that Russia and the United States will be brought together in some type of cataclysm. And, of course, Chapter 11, The Inevitable End of the Empire, speaks for itself. Chapter 12, Upon Returning from the Middle East, is my thoughts and perspective after I have returned from the Middle East. And that's the brief breakdown of the book in terms of chapters. Now, you can find it on Amazon. It's $14.95 on Amazon.com, which is not a bad price for the book. And, of course, shipping and handling fees will apply also. But I highly encourage you to buy this book. And if you've got somebody who's perhaps interested in the Syrian crisis or is even somewhat open to the Syrian crisis, then I encourage you to get them this book and let them see it, take a look at it, and work through it, and this will explain all of the different aspects to the crisis. Now, let's look briefly, before we get into anything else, about the Amnesty International report. I did this article, Amnesty International Human Slaughterhouse Report Lacks Evidence, Credibility, Reeks of State Department Propaganda. Now, we have another act of convenient timing. Amnesty International released this alleged bombshell report, which alleges the execution by hanging of 13,000 Syrian prisoners by the Syrian government in a period that goes from 2011 to 2015. And the report, which is entitled Human Slaughterhouse, Mass Hangings and Extermination at Saidnaya Prison, Syria, which it contains rather detailed descriptions of torture and rape and execution as well as other horrific activity. It's no doubt caught the attention of many people. Even the people who followed the events transpiring in Syria for the last 6 years are now raising their eyebrows about it. But it lacks one important aspect, and that is, of course, evidence. Now, at first glance, the report might sound convincing. Adequate reading of the text, if you take a look at it, actually reveals it to be yet another Western propaganda piece that's designed to demonize the Assad government shortly before important talks take place in Switzerland. And this report contains the right buzzwords, like extermination campaign. It reads like a story recounting a Nazi concentration camp, so it's to jog the ever-present memory of the Holocaust and cause the reader to subconsciously and consciously associate the Nazi slaughter of the Jews with the alleged Assad execution of 13,000 prisoners. We're going to give them credit for good writing, but we're going to also point out that good writing with no evidence is just a piece of fiction. And that's what this is. So I want to go through a number of reasons to question the integrity of the Amnesty International report and Amnesty International in general. So the first thing we have to look at in terms of this report is the timing. The report was released conveniently 2 weeks before talks are set to begin in Switzerland between the Syrian government and the so-called opposition. And this is no accident. We already see suit-wearing terrorists crying about the Syria peace talks scheduled in 2 weeks that it must address the report and the accusations. This convenient timing brings to mind the now infamous Caesar report, which was produced and paraded around Western media as fact, when it was nothing more than Qatari-sponsored propaganda. Now, we also want to look at the numbers. It's important to take a look at the numbers that are cited by Amnesty International here. Well, the Western media is doing its best to raise the numbers even higher. It's citing at least 13,000 now. We should examine the claims of the 13,000, but the Western media has now gone up to 50,000 and hyperbole of 2017. We need to examine the original claims of the report, though. Forget what the media is saying. They're not even coming from the report. They're making stuff up. So let's look at the 13,000. The numbers are not 13,000. They're some. This, according to the report, they are somewhere between 5,000 and 13,000, which leaves us a variation of 8,000 people. Now, we might have 5,000 people being executed alone. That might seem like a large number, but if we have a margin of error that's actually larger than half of the highest estimate, that we now see how this is so questionable. Now, if we look at these numbers, let's look at the executive summary in the report. It says, from December 2015 to December 2016, Amnesty International researched the patterns, sequence, and scale of violations carried out at Saidnaya prison, military prison, Saidnaya. In the course of this investigation, the organization interviewed 31 men who were detained at Saidnaya, 4 prison officials or guards who previously worked at Saidnaya, 3 former Syrian judges, 3 doctors who worked at Tishrin Military Hospital, 4 Syrian lawyers, 17 international and national experts on detention in Syria, and 22 family members of people who were or still are detained at Saidnaya. On the basis of evidence from people who worked within the prison authorities at Saidnaya and witness testimony from detainees, Amnesty International estimates that between 5,000 and 13,000 people were extrajudicially executed at Saidnaya between September 2011 and December 2015. End quote. So, where are these numbers coming from? The raw data in this report, that's presented in this report, is coming from 2 witnesses total. And even the raw data is an estimate from these alleged witnesses. And even the extrapolation from that raw data is an estimate from the estimate, right? So look at how the report explains the mechanism for determining how many people have been killed. And I'm reading from the report here. It says, people who worked within the prison authorities at Saidnaya told Amnesty International that extrajudicial executions related to the crisis in Syria first began in September 2011. Since that time, the frequency which they have been carried out has varied and increased. For the first 4 months, it was usual for between 7 and 20 people to be executed every 10 to 15 days. For the following 11 months, between 20 and 50 people were executed once a week, usually on Monday nights. For the subsequent 6 months, groups of between 20 and 50 people were executed once or twice a week, again, once or twice a week, usually on Monday and or Wednesday nights. Witness testimony from detainees suggests that the executions were conducted at a similar or even higher rate, at least until December 2015. Assuming that the death rate remained the same as the preceding period, again, assuming that the death rate remained the same, Amnesty International estimates that between 5,000 and 13,000 people were extrajudicially executed at Saidnaya between September 2011 and December 2015. Continuing in the report, these estimates were based on the following calculations. If between 7 and 20 were killed every 10 to 15 days from September to December 2011, the total figure would be between 56 people and 240 people for that period. If between 20 and 50 were killed every week between January and November 2012, the total figure would be between 880 and 2200 for that period. If between 20 and 50 people were killed in 222 execution sessions, assuming the executions were carried out twice a week, again assuming, and once a week, once a month, between December 2012 and December 2015, the total figure would be between 4,400 and 11,000 for that period. These calculations produce a minimum figure of 5,336, rounded down to the nearest thousand as 5,000, and 13,540, rounded down to the nearest thousand as 13,000. End quote. But you got note the variances of the numbers between X and Y, right? As well as the language demonstrating a lack of anything concrete, the report suggests once or twice a week, assuming all this stuff. So let's keep reading the report. Former detainees from the Red Building at Saidnaya provided Amnesty International with the names of 59 individuals who they witnessed being taken from their cells in the afternoon, being told that they were being transferred to civilian prisons in Syria. The evidence contained in this report strongly suggests that, in fact, these individuals were extrajudicially executed. Former prison guards and a former prison official from Saidnaya also provided Amnesty International with the name of 36 detainees who had been extrajudicially executed in Saidnaya since 2011. These 95 individuals are the only ones Amnesty is able to name. So with the report down from 13,000 to 95, it should be pointed out now that the ability to name does not equal proof of execution. And of course, I'm adding that little part. Just to point out, they mentioned 36 detainees, then 59 individuals. So that's 95 total. Those are the only ones Amnesty is able to name. So we went from 13,000 to 5,000 to 95. And again, the ability to name these people does not equal the proof of execution. Even with all the witnesses, there's very little evidence about these individuals. Remember, these individuals represent only 1 to 2% of the total numbers that were claimed by Amnesty. So let's go to the section of the report, documented deaths. Amnesty is forced to admit that the numbers of deaths cannot be proven, but it still tries to pad the numbers with deaths which are not from execution. And this is what the section of the report says. The exact number of deaths in Sidnaya is impossible to specify. However, the Syrian Network for Human Rights has verified and shared with Amnesty International the names of 375 individuals who have died in Sidnaya as a result of torture and other ill treatment between March 2011 and October 2016. Of these, 317 were civilians at the time of their arrest, 39 were members of the Syrian military, and 19 were members of non-state armed groups. In the course of the research for this report, Amnesty International obtained the names of 36 additional individuals who died as a result of torture and other ill treatment at Sidnaya. These names were provided to Amnesty International by former detainees who witnessed the deaths in their cells. End quote. So notice the source of the information, right? Syrian Network for Human Rights. Let's talk about the sources of this report, because this is very important. So who are these alleged witnesses and sources behind the report? To begin with, very few interviews were actually conducted in Syria, and the ones that were conducted remotely by Skype or telephone. Some were conducted in Lebanon, some were conducted in Jordan, there were some in Europe and the United States. Most were conducted in southern Turkey, which is the home base of ISIS and related terrorist factions that are being facilitated by Erdogan's government and funneled into Syria. But since Amnesty International has wisely been barred from entering Syria by the Syrian government, the organization admits that it does not have access to government-held territory, and it's hinting that it very well might have access to terrorist-held areas. This is what it says. Given that Amnesty International has been barred by the Syrian authorities from entering the country and has consequently not had access to government-controlled areas since 2011, the majority of these interviews were carried out in southern Turkey. The majority of these interviews took place in person in southern Turkey. The remaining interviews were conducted by telephone or through other remote means, with interviewees still in Syria or with individuals based in Lebanon, Jordan, European countries, and the USA. End quote. So it mentions how it came to find the individuals that interviewed for the report. It says that it was put in contact with the relevant alleged victims or former perpetrators by various international NGOs like Umamu for Justice and Human Rights, the Syrian Network for Human Rights, and the Syrian Institute for Justice and Accountability. All these organizations that have profoundly misrepresented the facts on the ground, the opinions and voices of the Syrian people, and who have supported terrorists by acting as ISIS, Al-Qaeda, FSA propaganda organs. The Syrian Network for Human Rights is a notoriously shady organization that many people believe to be associated with British intelligence. It's known for rather ridiculous claims about casualties caused by various sides of the conflict. It is not known what Syrian Network for Human Rights qualifies as civilians. They appear to possibly include armed militias. Note that none of the mostly civilians in the organization's claims to have died in the prison are said to have been executed. So how is it possible that an organization frequently quoted in the media as detailed source of casualties in Syria has no record of 5 to 13,000 people that Amnesty claims were executed? And it's again, it's imperative that we point out the Amnesty International report is based on interviews conducted with individuals all over the world who claim to have been victims and perpetrators, or mostly outside of Syria or located in terrorist havens. These individuals were recommended to Amnesty International via three NGOs who are notoriously biased, anti-Assad, pro-terrorist, and potentially wings of intelligence operations. Nowhere in this report is there any attempt to provide a different or contrary opinion. All this information is presented as fact. It does not sound legitimate. Now let's look at the witness testimony then. Without going into the details of which witness statements on the report, they seem at least exaggerated and are not necessarily verifiable. In fact, they're not verifiable at all. It's pure hearsay that this report is being built on. Again, an example from page 25 of the report. It says, Hamid, a former military officer when he was arrested in 2012, recalled the sounds he heard at night during an execution. There was a sound of something being pulled out, like a piece of wood, I'm not sure, and then you would hear the sound of them being strangled. If you put your ears on the floor, you could hear the sound of a kind of gurgling. This would last around 10 minutes. We were sleeping on top of the sound of people choking to death. This was normal for me then. Now, a court might accept sound of, or I'm not sure, or kind of gurgling, something like that, as proof that a shower was running somewhere, but as proof of executions, we think not. Of all the witnesses Amnesty says interviewed, only two of them, which was the former prison official and a former judge, who describe actual executions. From the wording of their statements, it's unclear if they have witnessed any hangings themselves or just described something that they've been told of. Now, here is one of the most ridiculous claims in my book, and one of the things that really sets the alarm bells off for me, and this is the attempt to malign the Grand Mufti and try to represent a Syria that doesn't exist. The military court procedures that are described in the report have one flaw, right? It should stand out to anybody who really even has a passing understanding of Syrian society and culture. This is the claim that the Grand Mufti of Syria, this is a guy by the name of Sheikh Ahmad Bahreddin Hassoun, that he is involved in the approval of orders to execute prisoners. On page 19 of the report, this is what it says. Quote, the judgment is sent by military post to the Grand Mufti of Syria and to either the Minister of Defense or the Chief of Staff of the Army, who are deputized to sign for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and who specify the date of the execution, end quote. But the report seems to forget a couple of things. First, that the Grand Mufti is a well-known moderate who has repeatedly called for peace throughout the conflict. In fact, the position of the Grand Mufti is civil only, and he only pronounces judgment in matters related to certain members of the Sunni faith, similar, although it's not identical, but it's similar to a bishop in the Catholic Church. It would be vastly out of character and vastly contradictory for the Grand Mufti to take part in anything like this. It would also be out of character for the Syrian government to consult a Grand Mufti or any religious leader in regards to war policy. But, again, the Western media portrays Assad as a sectarian, right? But Assad is Alawite, which is a branch of Shiite Islam. So why would the sectarian Alawite consult a sectarian Grand Mufti? He's Sunni. The report also misses an obvious fact, which is that Syria is a secular society, and perhaps Amnesty International's experts are ignorant, or they simply believe the Western public is so gullible that details like that don't matter. But unlike prehistoric states like Saudi Arabia, Syria is a government of civil law, not the religious. And another possibility we could add is that Amnesty's witnesses that are so closely aligned with the opposition are unaware of how secular societies work, since they're being so used to having religious authorities governing every aspect of their life that they unwittingly include a jihadist culture into their depiction of Syrian culture. We might not ever know the answer to that, but we do know that the representation of Syrian culture provided by Amnesty is inaccurate, to say the least. Now, the satellite images. Another source provoking questions about the veracity of the report are the satellite images that are reportedly showing mass graves near South Damascus. Now, what can we say about these satellite images other than they don't show mass graves near Damascus? They don't show it at all. They show an expansion of a cemetery and in a country that has had 400,000 people dead as a result of the war. We do expect expansions of cemeteries, especially outside a major city. So these photos are grasping at straws, to say the very least. Now let's talk about Amnesty International. I recommend a great article by Tony Cartolucci of Land Destroyer Report, which is called Amnesty International is U.S. State Department Propaganda. And he reveals the nature of Amnesty International, but we'll refer you to that report right now. We're just going to go through parts of our own work and some of Tony's, and just to try to expose what this Amnesty International is. Amnesty is supporting the U.S. State Department's agenda. That is not a surprise. It is literally run by the U.S. State Department's Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Organizations, Suzanne Nossel. Many people, unfortunately, consider Amnesty International sort of the final word on human rights organizations, but on human rights issues, but it might surprise some people to know that Amnesty International is, in fact, one of the greatest obstacles to real human rights advocacy on Earth. In its own 2012 annual report, page 4, Amnesty reiterates one of the biggest lies that it routinely tells, right? It says, Amnesty International is funded mainly by its membership and public donations. No funds are sought or accepted from governments for investigating and campaigning against human rights abuses. Amnesty International is independent of any government, political ideology, economic threat, or religion. Well, that's false. Amnesty International is indeed funded and run by not only governments, but also immense corporate financier interests, and it's not only absolutely entwined with political ideology and economic interests, it's an essential tool for making sure that those interests see their agendas go through. Finding information in terms of finances on Amnesty International's website is purposely difficult, especially when it comes to protecting the myth that the organization is independent. Any organized criminal operation like Amnesty tries to separate their financial ties through a series of legal maneuvers and shell organizations. And on Amnesty's website, you'll find this. It says, the work carried out through Amnesty International's International Secretariat is organized into two legal entities in compliance with United Kingdom law. These are Amnesty International Limited, the AIL, and Amnesty International Charity Limited, AICL. Amnesty International Limited undertakes charitable activities on behalf of Amnesty International Charity Limited, a registered charity. So there you see it. Amnesty International Limited, where ties to governments and corporate financier interests are kept. We look on page 11 of Amnesty International Limited's 2011 report and financial statement. It says, the directors are pleased to acknowledge the support of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Oak Foundation, Open Society Georgia Foundation, the Vanguard Charitable Endowment Program, Morrow Tunes, and American Jewish World Service. The UK Department for International Development Government and Transparency Fund continue to fund a four-year human rights education project in Africa. The European Commission, Europe Aid, generally awarded a multi-year grant towards Amnesty International's human rights and education work in Europe. Okay, so Amnesty does take money from both governments and corporate financier interests, and one of the most notorious of which, the Open Society, is headed by George Soros. It was March 2012, reported by Bloomberg, Soros loses case against French insider trading conviction, indicating an appeal based on human rights violation against Wall Street speculator George Soros has been rejected by the European Court of Human Rights. Soros's Open Society also funds Human Rights Watch and a number of other human rights organizations that literally attempted to use the West human rights racket to defend itself against charges of financial fraud, and perhaps the most transparent illustration of how this racket operates. Soros was convicted and fined for insider trading in 2002 regarding the French bank Société Générale. He bought those shares in 1988, built an empire out of obfuscating global criminal activity with the cause of human rights. And his support, as well as that of the British and European governments of Amnesty International, is solely aimed at expanding this obfuscation. Now, the leadership of Amnesty International, who are they? Suzanne Nossel, she's the executive director of Amnesty International USA. She was drawn directly from the U.S. State Department, again, contracting Amnesty's claim of being independent of governments. Nossel continued promoting U.S. foreign policy, but simply behind a podium with a new logo. Amnesty International's logo was attached to it instead of the State Department's, but she continued promoting the same thing. Amnesty International's website specifically mentions Nossel's role behind the U.S. State Department-backed U.N. resolutions regarding Iran, Syria, Libya, and the Ivory Coast. A glance at AmnestyUSA.org reveals that each and every front the U.S. State Department is currently working on is prioritized, and is currently prioritized by Amnesty International as well. This includes rallies and campaigns to support the State Department-funded Russian opposition groups like Pussy Riot and others, undermining the Syrian government, toppling the government of Belarus, supporting Wall Street, London created Aung San Suu Kyi of Myanmar, still called by Burma by Suu Kyi herself. So you can take a look at that. But this report, at best, I would say, is a faulty and poorly produced distortion of some disturbing reports from dubious sources, exaggerated for the purpose of demonizing Assad and the Syrian government. It simply cannot be believed and has no credibility whatsoever. The lack of understanding of Syrian culture, the straws that are being grasped at when it comes to the satellite photos, dubious NGO influence, terrorist link sources, lack of credible witnesses, virtually every bit of evidence is being produced rests on these credible witnesses, all serve the purpose of destroying Amnesty's own propaganda before it can even really get off the ground. We can put Amnesty now in the ranks of Human Rights Watch, which is apparently running for which organization can produce the most ridiculous yet effective propaganda against the Syrian government. So we know that Amnesty has long been known as the State Department propaganda organ for some time. This report is just evidence to back up the claims and placing it in its proper place as a State Department propaganda organ. Now, in regards to that report, I'd like to draw your attention to one more article that's posted up at BrandonTurbeville.com by Hanin Elias. She was born in Germany, but she's the daughter of a Syrian doctor and a German doctor's assistant. She spent her childhood in Damascus and Aleppo. She's also the co-founder of the band Atari Teenage Riot, founder of Fatal Recordings, political activist. She toured with Rage Against the Machine, Wu-Tang Clan, Nine Inch Nails. She also released an album under the name Fantome, entitled It All Makes Sense. She's released 13 albums as a solo artist. And she wrote this article for BrandonTurbeville.com. It's entitled MSM and Human Rights NGOs Promote War, Remain Silent When Propaganda is Proven False. Now, it's also about the human rights, the Amnesty International report, and I would highly encourage you to go check that out. What else do we want to draw attention to? There are a couple of debates now going on within the alternative media, and there's several. We just had a few take place over the past week. We've seen debates between anarchists, different types of anarchists. We've seen debates between anarchists and non-anarchists. We've seen debates between socialists, socialists, anarchists, socialists, and non-anarchists. It goes back and forth within the alternative media, and it seems to me that people are finally reaching a point where they realize that the alternative media has been spending a lot of time criticizing the system, rightly so, but we're now reaching a point at which we are going to have to make a decision about what we want to do, or at least start looking at ways to implement the changes. Anarchists have one one idea, non-anarchists have another. They're all different, even disagreements within each other's camp. We just saw a very interesting debate by Jay Dyer and Adam Kokesh. And, you know, I can say personally that I agreed and disagreed with both of them on much of the talk, much of the debate. It's a two-hour debate. Adam obviously was representing the anarchist position. Jay was representing the non-anarchist position. And as long as the debates can go about the way that Jay and Adam's debate went, which is two individuals with mutual respect from one another who are able to discuss very different positions and present them in a way and debate them without dissolving into insults and petty whining and bitching and name-calling, as we've seen some, I guess, the previous generation of alt-media writers and stuff do, the ability to realize that other people might have a different view of the world than you do without necessarily having to excommunicate them or kill them or to berate them. This is a positive new development. And hopefully the people who are unable to grasp the fact that people who have different opinions of them exist are going to weed themselves out of the alternative media by simply isolating themselves, and we hope that's what's going to happen. But we also encourage the alternative media and people who read it and activists to really start thinking about what the world we want to bring in is going to look like. And I've given a number of points in my 43 points article. Basically, what I want to do is to ask the question, is what do we want to look at in terms of a state? Now, I know anarchists will say there shouldn't be a state. We don't agree with that. But the question is, what should a state do? Should it be a state? Should it be a nanny state that does everything for everybody all the time? Or should it be the libertarian version of the micro-state? And these are the questions that we observe. And in our position here, a state should do a number of things. And the first thing it should do is, of course, protect and defend the rights of the individual. And this is a rejection of collectivism. It's also a rejection of anarchy. It's not that you do not have to have anarchy to promote individual rights. Yes, the penultimate is, of course, the individual, because without the individual, you don't have the basis of a collective, which is supposedly individuals who are come together in a collective. So the rights of protecting the rights of the individual are, of course, the hallmarks of what a state should be. Secondly, security from outside invasion. So it's physical protection of the individual, right? It's a collective act of protection against foreign powers who may seek to do harm to the members of that society. This would be a military to prevent outside attacks or invasions, the destruction of that society. And of course, what is the other position of the government, the state? It is to provide for, yes, the general welfare. And the question is, how do we interpret the term general welfare? And this is going to be tricky, but you will see a lot of people have very different ideas. And in our perspective, the general welfare is, of course, something that cannot violate rights. That is the first prerequisite of the general welfare. It cannot violate human rights, constitutional rights, God-given rights, etc. Thus saying we want to promote the general welfare by banning guns, then that's not legitimate, because you're not promoting the general welfare if you are impeding on basic rights. But providing for the general welfare in the sense that it is regulating the economy, for instance, that it is ensuring that Wall Street banks, big corporations, cannot become corporate feudal overlords. This is the goal, that it's supposed to be imposing tariffs so that there is an element of protectionism and that that people in this country will have jobs and high living standards, etc. Paying attention to wages and paying attention to working standards and living standards, sanitation and infrastructure and this type of thing. So in one sense, we want a state that is heavily involved in terms of the economy, but also a state that is hands-off in terms of individual rights and in terms of non-threatening economic action. And when I say non-threatening economic action, I mean things like derivatives or monopolies, right? So we're not talking about basic commerce. So this is the idea of what I wanted to suggest is the concept of what the state should be, since there is so much discussion about it. And I think that a lot of people would realize if something like that were implemented that the state itself is not necessarily an evil concept. With this new step forward that I'm frankly happy to see in the alternative media, because it wasn't just the Dyer-Kokesh debate. There have been other debates that have taken place. Then we are definitely turning a corner in which we are deciding the directions in which we want to go. We are putting together platforms, demands, in a sense, and a clear direction for the direction in which we want to go and the people who are looking at it. And that's good. Obviously, we've thrown our two cents in with the 43 points, and we continue to want more people to take a look at that. That's the direction we want to go, obviously. But it's going to take there's going to be a lot of people out there with a lot of different ideas, some conflicting and whatever. But, of course, what we would like to say is that we extend open arms to anyone in the alternative media who's willing to work with us on any aspect, right? So I've said this before many times. If you're an anarchist who believes there should be no laws against marijuana, and you're a socialist who believes that there should be no laws against marijuana, then us, being neither anarchist or socialist, are happy to link arms with you to prevent laws prohibiting marijuana. This is how we want to interact. And then we can argue about economic policy, and we can argue about guns, and we can argue about everything else under the sun after we eliminate laws against marijuana. So this is the type of cooperation that we are looking for. It's enlightened mutual self-interest. And that's, I think we'd do so much better as a society, especially as a movement, if we interacted something like that or implemented a strategy like that. So I just thought I'd throw that out there in terms of the discussions that have been taking place over the week, so people can get an idea of what we're looking at in terms of a state, so it becomes more clear. Now, in the closing part of the broadcast, I'm going to air a very short clip by Alan Watt, CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com. Of course, you can find it at CuttingThroughTheMatrix.net. He has several other websites as well. He has a show here on UCY, which is on after mine, Cutting Through the Matrix. And this is a broadcast that took place on April 7th, 2011. It's only about 15 minutes or so, and I want to end the show with that. I think people should definitely check out his work. And we'll be back next week with some more information, and we'll have talk look about guiding strategy as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Brandon Turbeville. This has been Truth on the Tracks. We'll see you next week.
There's all the stuff that comes from the think tanks, where they take every possible thing that could go wrong in the world, including nuclear disasters, including getting hit with comets or meteorites or whatever, and they try to figure out ways that this elite could survive. And it's not a new thing. They've been doing this all along. They've had their underground bases all through the Cold War, using your tax money to ensure that they do indeed survive. And we've had articles in the mainstream too about incoming possible asteroids and all this stuff. They literally leave nothing to chance. But they also go through everything with military strategy to do with social policy, because the public have a function that is to be a good, dutiful citizen, work and consume and do what you're told, go to the army when they tell you to go and fight and kill whoever they want to kill at the time, and then come back and work and pay taxes. That's your duty as basically a citizen. It's an interesting term, citizen, because it started a long time in ancient times too, when money came in and the first cities were formed. Cities could not be formed, in fact, without cash, without money flowing. They can't feed themselves in a city. They live on a kind of supra type of work, which is to do with passing paper around and numbers around, and to do with companies and so on, not with actually manufacturing anything in itself as such. So this is a system into which you're born, and you've all noticed, I'm sure, that you're rapidly changing. It's all rapidly changing around you, and the big boys are on a move. And it's a move that was planned a long time ago. They're not hurried up because of what's happening in Japan at all, although they'll use that to their advantage. And they're going ahead with what they said they'd do with, for instance, the Bretton Woods Agreement Part 2. I've talked about that for a few years because John Maynard Keynes was a guy who gave you your present monetary system and for the governments to adopt, and basically the off the gold standards, all that kind of stuff. But Keynes himself said that this would only be part one, and now of course we've got part two coming up. The IMF's been pushing for it, and I've talked before, you've heard it in my archive section, where Keynes's speech, his last speech was published, and he talked about the part two that would come in. Now Keynes was an ardent Fabian type socialist. And again, I have to tell socialists, a lot of socialists don't really know what socialism is. They think they know what it is. And I've talked to many of them. I've talked to Marxists too, that had never read Lenin or anything else. Justice for the working man. That's what they think. And a lot of socialists think, well, it's when government puts the cash that they take off you back into the society. And that sounds all wonderful. But you understand, those at the top have a higher understanding and a different understanding of socialism. It was the same with communism. The Politburo were given one version of what they were working for. The working class were given a different version. And Lenin himself said only the top members were allowed to know the true goals and aims of communism. It's the same with socialism. But we've had enough of slaughters throughout the last century, and here we are into this world doing more slaughtering, pretending with this farce it's to bring equality and social democracy across the planet. Utter rubbish, the stuff that was put out by the think tanks for George Bush is being used by Obama, who has even been congratulated by Rumsfeld of the New American Century Group, who planned all these invasions back in the 90s, by the way, for carrying on the same tradition. But Obama or no, it makes no difference, because I don't care if you put a puppet up there, I mean a literal puppet on strings, or even a muppet, that would do the job just as well, because they're given their lines to speak, the scripts are written for them by professional script writers who are more savvy about the agenda than the front men who have to read them. And we're on a roll now into this new world order, as they say. The New World Order has been always transitioning itself for years into parts. It's partitioned, part 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., etc., etc. And I've said for years this 21st century was to be the new century, the century of change. And that was a term used by academia, who, of course, are all funded by the big foundations, which are run on behalf of the banking boys, again, the banking elite families. And the century of change was to bring in a world type of collectivist socialism run by professionals, above them academia, who would run the world in a non-democratic fashion. They'd know what was best for us, and we'd simply have the laws thrown upon us, heaped upon us, in fact, and we'd simply obey. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. And that really was the goal, too, of Fabian socialism, for those who don't know what socialism really is. There's still that link up there. I went through the Soviet story, and on there, of course, you have one of the founders, George Bernard Shaw, of Fabian socialism, giving his speech about the world to come, the same H.G. Wellsian type of utopia, where you'd have to go to the big boys and defend your right to exist to them. He wanted to gas all the useless eaters. Back with more after this break.
I don't want to punish anybody. But there are an extraordinary number of people whom I want to kill. I think it would be a good thing to make everybody come before a properly appointed board, just as he might come before the income tax commissioners, and say every 5 years or every 7 years, just put him there and say, sir or madam, now will you be kind enough to justify your existence? If you're not producing as much as you consume, or perhaps a little more, then clearly we cannot use the big organization of our society for the purpose of keeping you alive, because your life does not benefit us, and it can't be of very much use to yourself.
And this was actually somewhat subtle for Shaw. He'd also foreshadow some of the worst atrocities in our planet's history. He wrote, I appeal to the chemists to discover a humane gas that will kill instantly and painlessly. In short, a gentlemanly gas, deadly by all means, but humane, not cruel.
Hi folks, we're back and we're cutting through the matrix, just talking about the big system and how it's going along the way it's supposed to go, because they've been telling us what they're going to do for years from sites like the Council on Foreign Relations and their Foreign Affairs magazine and other articles that they put out there by the big think tanks, the big workers and shakers for the world, that they're employed, of course, by the big international bankers. Look into the foundations of the Royal Institute of International Affairs - Council on Foreign Relations. See the guys who started it up, the Rothschilds, Milner, Lord Milner, and who was German as well. And of course, their sons, of course, took over. And they actually fomented wars and owned medias to tell them that their sites had attacked, like the Boer War. They got the Boer War going because they wanted to grab the diamonds, fields, and the gold and silver and so on. This is factual. It's in the history books. And their own historian, Carl Quigley, wrote about it in Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment, the two books that you have to read to understand any of this that's really going on. And, of course, they want to bring in a world socialist-type system. They greatly admired the communist system because it created instant obedience. You get things done quickly. Same in China. That's why they love China. And China, of course, gets an order from the top, and everyone jumps into action and simply obeys. There's no arguing like you do in a so-called democratic society. We just get a show off the arguing because they all drink in the same pubs, basically. It doesn't matter what side they pretend they're on. But this is the reality in which we live, a communistic society. They're divvying up the world. They've already grabbed most of the resources of the planet. They're big corporations, which they own, literally own the food supply of the world. They're going for the water supply of the entire planet too, the drinkable water. And most folk out there are so brain injured with their indoctrination. And there's an incredible entertainment. I mean, who'd have thought that entertainment was the best drug to keep everyone dozy and stupid as all this is happening? But they have raised generations on television, and now they're going much further than just TV. And it works terribly, terribly well. Because people will escape from the negative into what they think is the positive, which is actually fiction, escapism, you see. And that's what they counted on back in the 30s and 40s, when big players for the same organization wrote in their own books that they would create an egocentric society, people who would seek pleasure and avoid pain, and narcissism would be pushed to its extreme. Well, you've got all of that today. And yet, they don't know that Rome is burning, basically. They don't know. And they can't imagine it ever happening. It was the same when the Goths and all the other ones invaded Rome. You'll find out, if you read Gibbons or any of the other historians on Rome, you'll find out that the people inside were actually partying. Big parties were going on at the time, big balls. And they couldn't believe when they were told that literally the barbarians were at the gate. They couldn't believe it. It doesn't happen to them. And the same thing is happening now, as big movers and shakers all outside of governmental offices are working with government to bring in the system, because government was bought and paid for a long time ago. If there ever was a free government, it was conquered a long time ago and taken over a long time ago, because they're all on board on the same agenda. They have told us we all exist to serve the economy. Really? Is that why you exist, to serve the economy? Did you know that's your reason for being? Well, that's what they tell you. Your reason to exist is to serve the economy. What's the economy? It's whatever they say it is. And it also means that they must tax you, you see. They got the right to tax you. Tax means labor. Labor. You tax yourself when you labor, you see. And they're taxing you. They call it taxes. It sounds better than labor, because technically, anyone who took money off your labor, which was actually your own labor, was putting you in a form of slavery. If it wasn't your employer, it's a form of slavery, you see. But we're conned, left, right, and center. Anyway, George Soros, as you know about George Soros, he's an incredible psychopath, well chosen, mind you, for his past histories, and picked up by Rothschild, it was, in fact, who picked him up. He's the kind of guy that they want. And he literally was risen to the ranks of a multimillionaire doing scams and sinking economies across the planet. But he is pushing for Bretton Woods Part 2. Just coincidentally, that's what the IMF was prattling on about a year and 2 years ago, Bretton Woods Part 2, and I read all that stuff on the air at the time. So remember, it ties in too with this New World Order, because they've said that the Council on Foreign Relations and governments have said it too with private public partnerships, that they're also bringing in philanthropists, big rich philanthropists, into this new makeup of the world to make decisions for us. People you don't elect, you see. And it says, apparently megalomaniacs need schedulers. This is from Fox News. Ask George Soros. The left-wing billionaires helping fund two major conferences start on the same day in two different locations, just 3 hours apart by car. Two liberal events packed into one long weekend. God created the world in 6 days. Apparently Soros, who sees himself as some kind of God, needs just a long weekend to start remaking today's world in his image. Now, he's obviously a front too, and he is a front, but he's got the right stuff. He's a pure, utter psychopath. It says the emphasis of both conferences is a familiar one to American voters. Change. Change is good. And Soros wants to begin by changing the global economy in one event. And the other, they want to change the world and change the media. Back with more after this break. Hi, folks. We're back, cutting through the matrix. Just talking about George Soros, just one player of many frontmen that are out there who are brought up to be multi-billionaires, and they do work for a master, of course. And believe you me, if he was a lone ranger here, he'd be bumped off by much bigger fish than him.
This is Ozzy Skateboard, and you're listening to UCY.TV.